welcome to New World Notes, edited by Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll hear more from Glenn Ford. He shows why U.S. foreign policy now seems to be mainly bombing, invading, and overthrowing anybody and everybody, and why the change from Bush to Obama is really no change at all. I hope you'll stay tuned. Glenn Ford is a black American, an intellectual, left of center politically, and well worth hearing. He spoke at Trinity College in Hartford on April 6. Last week, we heard the first part of his talk, titled Imperialism Hopping on Just One Leg. We'll hear more of that talk today. Last week, he argued that U.S. foreign policy is mostly about preventing China from becoming the most important country in the world. The U.S. cannot surpass China in economic power. Why? Because to increase its own short-term profits, Wall Street has torn down America's manufacturing base. So we can compete with China only by using our massive military to encircle China and limit its economic links with other developing nations. So argues Glenn Ford. This week, Ford develops these points more and connects them with the U.S.'s rejection of international law, its invasion of Iraq, and its more recent overthrow of the governments of Haiti and Libya. Here is Glenn Ford.
And that was the signal that the Lords of Capital, that is, Wall Street, had made a very important and pivotal decision. They had decided that they would dismantle the industrial capacity of the United States piece by piece. That's what they meant by globalization. And they would ship that industrial capacity off to the third world, not at that time to China, because the Chinese government at that time was not amenable to such investments. But they began shipping the industrial capacity off to various places in the global south, Mexico and Philippines and all kinds of places. Finance capitalists, and those are people who make nothing but monetize everything, that is, they turn everything into capital, were seeking to solve the contradiction of diminishing returns on investment by super exploitation of the labor of people overseas in the former third world. They used the International Monetary Fund to coerce unwilling countries to accept the terms of their exploitative investments. And if that didn't work, there was always the option of covert or even overt military pressure from the superpower or from its junior partners in Europe, especially the French, who have always been quite aggressive. Here at home, they started telling Americans that their stagnant wages and unemployment were caused by big government or by the unions or by lazy black people or because the United States workforce needed an upgrade in education. But the real problem was that finance capital's disinvestment in the making of things in the United States was having domestic consequences. They disinvested and people lost their jobs, and those who kept their jobs found that their wages were stagnating. You probably are wondering what all this has to do with U.S. lawlessness and with drone assassinations and with America's constant state of war. I am saying that it has everything to do with it, because that is what happens when the empire begins to collapse. And I maintain that this collapse definitively began with the triumph of finance capital over manufacturing capital. We have now been in this brave new world of the hegemony of finance capital for about 30 years. And the Lords of Capital, those people on Wall Street, have done very well in those 30 years. They now dominate the U.S. economy, and that means they dominate political life, and that's why we are caught in the kind of dead-end conversation that we are now, in which, for the first time in my lifetime, the rulers don't even fix their mouths to present a solution to your problem. They don't even make one up, because this is a monopolitical culture, the political culture of finance capital. In the first decade of the 21st century, the people who handle money have gone from raking in only no more than 16% of the corporate profits that were made in this country to going up to 41% in the first 10 years of the 21st century, a 41% share to finance capital. And even after the meltdown of 2008, they are now taking in 30% of the profits that are made by corporations here in the United States. This means that effectively they own the place. However, by temporarily overcoming their contradiction of falling rates of return on investment, that is, by shipping the United States industrial capacity overseas and super exploiting third world workers, they have deindustrialized the home country of the empire, and that must have consequences. That has, in fact, created a far more serious contradiction for the U.S. imperial system as a whole. You can't shift the center of the making of things, of human production, without shifting power at the same time. The bankers may have imagined that they could do so, that they could ship the factories off to China or to Mexico, but it cannot be done. They made that bargain, and now we face those consequences. The deindustrialization of the United States and of Europe has inevitably empowered the global South, where the manufacturing occurs. And especially it has empowered China, but also India and Brazil and elsewhere in the manufacturing sectors of the formerly Third World. Those countries have also amassed capital. They have stores of money. They've amassed it from their positions as the manufacturers of goods, and also some of them are the providers of raw natural resources as well, so that Brazil's development bank portfolio is now bigger than the World Bank, and China holds more than $1 trillion in U.S. debt. Those countries are now, because of this 30-year period, they are now able to make deals with their developing nation partners. Those are deals, the kinds of deals that the United States either cannot make, does not have the capacity to make, or refuses to make. So the United States now does not even compete on many levels of trade with China, does not even bother. China makes good deals. China builds ports and railways for its partners in the developing world so as to facilitate trade. And those railways are there to stay, and the ports are there to stay. And that is why China has surpassed the United States in trade with Africa and even trade with South America right in Washington's own backyard. The United States has all but given up trying to compete. Wall Street isn't really interested in long-term development of the global South. Wall Street makes its money by rigging markets and attacking markets, as it's doing in Europe right now, and by manipulating process. It plays with money. It does not make long-term productive investment. That is not what money capitalists do. The U.S. then is left with one strategic asset in the world. It has one strength, which is unchallenged, and that is its military. The U.S. and its NATO allies account for 70% of all the arms spending on planet Earth. That is their trump card, and that is the card that they are playing. It's now all about force of arms. It's not about soft power. It's just about hard power. That is the guns and the drones and the threats and the bullying. That means there is no room any longer in their policy decisions for the rule of law. And therefore, the rule of law must be discarded. They make their way in the world by the gun now, and the rule of law and the rule of the gun are antithetical. I believe that when we see the world that way, when we look at the United States as not a power whose policies and whose national personality is somehow distorted by cowboy bushes and such, by these caricatures that people make of Republicans and then contrast with the more urbane, cosmopolitan, reasonable-sounding Obama. When we understand the actual position that the United States is in, when we realize that it does not, through its eyes, through the eyes of policy planners and war makers, that it does not have any choice but to do as it does, that the world actually makes more sense. You may think it's scarier, but I don't think so. I think it's much more predictable, and that the end of this imperial rage is also something that we can foresee, as long as we understand that it is behaving according to the laws of economics. Iraq, which was seen as such a great mistake that it was the product of, some kind of Texas insanity, actually makes great sense if the imperial planners see what I think they see, what I believe exists. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 was not supposed to be limited to Iraq. It was not just to seize Iraq's oil fields, as wealthy as they, as and important as they are. That attack, and we know a great deal about it through leaked intelligence, was supposed to begin with the occupation of Iraq and then project American power, possibly American troops, but certainly American power, deep into Central Asia, into the former stands of the Soviet Union. It was part of the planned encirclement of China. Remember, the United States cannot, will not, is not in any position to resist the growth of China as well as Brazil and other rising powers. It seeks only to interpose itself, to put itself in a position where it can coerce and bully China. It does not necessarily want to bring down the Chinese regime, because a host of American companies are only nominally American companies now. They are really Chinese companies, which can call upon the United States because of their headquarters here to run the international protection racket for them. U.S. capitalist assets are deeply embedded in China. But the United States, in order to maintain its position and having only one card to play, must play that military card. And so the United States rolled the dice with Iraq, hoping to interpose itself, to put itself in a position to coerce and bully China by sitting astride trade routes that either exist or are in the planning to integrate China and the European as well as other markets. It rolled the dice, and the Iraqi resistance made those dice go crap. And it was a great humiliation to the United States. It was a catastrophe. And the U.S. got humble again, so humble that the powers that be realized they had to change the face of U.S. imperialism. They had to change the accent and the tone, not the goal, not the objective, because the objective remains the same because their assessment of their actual position in the world and what they must do remains the same. But they changed the face, and that face became democratic and black with the same objectives. The new face was, of course, Barack Obama. They changed their approach to subverting the rule of law. From the Bush approach, which was American unilateralism, we'll do what we want because we've got the guns to do what we want. Clearly, that didn't work in Iraq. They didn't bargain on the resistance. To a new doctrine. And that doctrine, although developed, discussed, promulgated before Barack Obama, is now the Obama doctrine. And that is humanitarian military intervention, responsibility to protect. This doctrine is much more insidious than American unilateralism. It goes to the heart of international law. And international law is centered, as we discussed, on the sovereignty of nations, on those accords and understandings that the United States itself was so instrumental in putting into effect after World War II. It made the sovereignty of nations the centerpiece of international law. Humanitarian military intervention is a dagger at the heart of national sovereignty. It says that the world community, which in the real world means the United States and whoever it designates as its partners, has the right to decide whether a government is worthy of representing a nation. And if that world community, meaning the United States and its allies, decides that it is an unworthy government, then that government, in the service of the population of that country, for humanitarian reasons, that government, that regime change can be effected. It flies in the face of all the fundamental principles of respect for national sovereignty. It gives the United States supranational powers. And it says that, and this is most important, it says that war is not the very last resort. It is the good resort. It is the good thing to do. All of the post-war international law goes out the window with humanitarian intervention. Many people say that this R2P, humanitarian military intervention, got its start in the intervention in Yugoslavia. And I agree, that's true. But I think that the Haitian experience is a much purer one and allows us to see the beast as it really is. In 2004, the United States overthrew the democratically elected government of Haiti under President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. It had fomented a so-called rebellion. It was more of a mercenary action for over a year, with the Democratic and Republican foreign policy units contributing greatly to funneling arms and all kinds of aid to these rebels, many of them former Tonton Macoutes and terrorists who were based in the Dominican Republic. And then on cue, these rebels crossed the border from the Dominican Republic with brand new M16s distributed by the Dominican government as a conduit and terrorized the countryside, creating what the United States called a humanitarian disaster, a disaster, of course, created by the United States. And the United States then sent in the U.S. Marines, kidnapped Jean-Bertrand Aristide, put him on a plane, and took him to a French base in the former French colony of the Central African Republic. This was a blatant violation of I can't tell how many international laws. But the United States said this was the humanitarian thing to do. Haiti, as I said, its government was democratically elected. There were not even allegations that this government was carrying out any kinds of atrocities. The United States simply removed the man, placed United States Marines on Haitian soil, and then, through its clout at the United Nations, through the United Nations Security Council, made Haiti into what must be described as a kind of protectorate. Now, when you're a protectorate of the world community, you're really not protected by anyone. And so Haiti's sovereignty was stolen without a whimper from the suspects that you would think would make noise. And that includes most of established Black America. Haiti languished under this protectorate status until the earthquake, which seemed to give some ex post facto justification for the United Nations occupation of the country. And the UN, of course, made its contribution to Haiti's welfare by bringing cholera to the country. And just last week, the United Nations declared itself to be immune from any liability for the 8,000 people in Haiti who have died. Now, this immunity, I think, is significant because it's what sovereigns claim. So now I suppose that the United Nations is sovereign over Haiti, and Haiti has no sovereignty of its own. We see here with a country that not only offended no other country because it could not, Haiti does not have the capacity to offend any other country, and which was not even alleged to have committed any kinds of atrocities against its own people, can, by the United States, be stripped of its sovereignty. I think this is the clearest example of all of how the United States is methodically undermining international law at its most fundamental level because it could. And the U.S. is quite pleased with what it has done, so pleased that it has lost all shame and put George Bush and Bill Clinton as the kind of rajas over this captive people. The second big escalation of this war on international law through humanitarian military intervention was, of course, the attack against Libya. So let's put that in context. When the Arab Spring, as it was called, erupted, one could see just by watching the behavior of CNN and the other corporate media, one could see that the U.S. State Department and White House and Pentagon had no idea how to respond to what they feared would be a drastic realignment of forces in the Middle East. They understand that if there is anything remotely resembling a democracy in the Middle East, the United States will be evicted forthwith. It is not well-liked in that part of the world. And they didn't know what to do. And you could tell that they didn't know what to do because CNN did not know what to say. CNN was not provided a script by the State Department or the Pentagon. And so they just kind of mumbled for 3 or 4 days until they got their cues from the United States government. What the United States and its NATO allies decided to do was to get ahead of the curve and change the chemistry of this so-called Arab Spring by a massive show of force. I do not believe that the United States, prior to these events that we call the Arab Spring, had any intention of attacking Muammar Gaddafi. He had accommodated himself, his country, to Europe especially, and to the United States. He presented no threat whatsoever. I want to remind people that Gaddafi's Libya was the first country to go to Interpol to get an arrest warrant for Osama bin Laden. Gaddafi had been in a state of war with the jihadists for a very long time, and it killed a whole bunch of them, and was collaborating with the United States in its so-called war on terror. Whether you think that's a good thing or not, he did not present any threat to the United States. But he was already thoroughly demonized in the eyes of European and American audiences figure. And therefore, in terms of the domestic reaction, well, you can't go wrong by attacking Gaddafi. So this doctrine of humanitarian intervention was put to another test, and you know what happened there. 7 months of a bombing campaign resulting in regime change and the killing of Gaddafi. But the point here, for my purposes this evening, is what occurred afterwards. The bombing is over, and the objective has been achieved, and President Obama tells the United States Congress that there is no reason for him to report to Congress in terms of the War Powers Act. He tells the Congress that there was no war, despite tens of thousands of sorties. And there was no war because no Americans were killed. And so here we have another Obama doctrine, another layer. According to this Obama doctrine, it does not matter how many people the United States kills. It does not matter how many regimes are overthrown. It does not matter how much firepower, how much force is applied on someone else's soil. There is no war unless Americans die in the process. I cannot think of anything that is a greater violation of the very idea of law in the conduct of nations. If I have the technical and military means to kill you without myself being injured, then I have every right to do it, and we won't even call it a war. We won't even call it hostilities. And his administration's spokespersons actually said that no state of even hostilities existed between the United States and Libya. If that is not a methodical attack on international law, I don't know what is.
And here we'll pause Glenn Ford's brilliant take on U.S. foreign policy. And you can see where Obama's bizarre doctrines are leading. More and more drone warfare. If no Americans are killed, claims Obama, then it's not warfare. It's not even hostilities. It's just a kiss on the cheek. Next week, we'll hear the conclusion of Glenn Ford's talk and some other neat stuff besides. You can catch any of our shows that you missed at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non carborundum, eat more kale, and, as Claude Coburn famously advised, never believe anything until you've seen the official denial. Ciao.